Hi, and welcome to the Crime Pod. I'm Sam.
And I'm Caitlin.
This week was a case recommended by Lindsay, so thank you for this. I'm back in the early 1900s, and so at least with this recommendation, I have the comfort of knowing at least one other person enjoys my ancient cases. So thank you again. This week, I'm going to tell you about the Brides in the Bath murderer, known as George Joseph Smith. So, Caitlin, have you heard of this one?
Yes.
You have?
I have. I don't know anything about it.
But you've heard of it, and that's the main thing.
Yes, I have heard of it. So I'm looking forward to finding out more information about it.
Perfect. Great. Well, I will just begin. George Joseph Smith, he was born on the 11th of January, 1872. He was born in Bethnal Green and his father was an insurance agent. I don't know much else about that. He was sent to a reformatory at Gravesend at the age of 9 and he later served time for swindling and theft. In 1896, he was imprisoned for 12 months for persuading a woman to steal from her employers. He then used the proceeds that she stole from her employers with to open a baker's shop in Leicester. So this was probably the last time that he did something legitimately, as in he worked for, albeit it wasn't very legitimate because he opened it up with stolen money, but I mean, he then worked.
I was going to say, we're using the term legitimately, yep, quite loosely.
Very loosely, very loosely. Now, in 1898, he married Caroline Beatrice Thornhill. And one thing about George Smith is he had multiple aliases. So he married Caroline under another alias of Oliver George Love. And he's still in Leicester. And it was actually his only legal marriage. Now, go on, he did marry a lot after. However, it was all bigamously. They moved to London, where she worked as a maid for a number of employers, and she would actually steal from her employers for her husband. She was eventually caught in Worthing, and she was sentenced to 12 months in prison. On her release, she actually incriminated her husband and he was then imprisoned for 2 years in January 1901. Now, on his release, Mrs. Love fled to Canada because back then, and also now kind of all the time, but there was a spur, especially where a lot of like people from the UK and Scotland moved to Canada. So big shout out to Canada because half, like everybody knows at least one person in Canada, I would say. Do you know anyone in Canada, Caitlin?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I know a couple of people around Canada. Yeah.
Yeah.
But exactly. They do a lot of skiing. It wouldn't be the life for me.
Yeah, well, it's too cold. But it's beautiful. I'd love to go. It's on my list. Anyway, we digress. So Smith then went back to his other wife and cleared out her savings. And then he left. Now, it's unknown how many women he actually treated in this manner in the years following, but it seemed that, you know, he'd meet someone, clear them out of all their savings, and then leave. What is known, though, is that in June 1908, Smith married a widow from Worthing, Florence Wilson. On the 3rd of July, he left her, but not before taking £30 from her savings account and selling all of her belongings from her residence. And then on the 30th of July, he then went on, so not like hardly even a month later, he then went on to marry Edith Pegler in Bristol, who she had actually replied to an advertisement for a housekeeper, you know, in the newspaper when you put all this information out and you can get a job from there. He would then disappear for months at a time, saying that he would go to another city to ply his trade, which he claimed that his trade was selling antiques. So in between all of his other marriages, Smith would always come back to Edith with money. In October 1909, under the name George Rose Smith, he married Sarah Freeman. As with Florence Wilson, he left her after clearing out her savings and selling her war bonds with a total take of £400. It was after this that he married Bessie Munday, and Alice Burnham after that. Between Alice Burnham and Margaret Lofty, this is how many wives he is having, okay? In September 1940...
I was going to say, I was getting confused there. I was like, are these still wives?
Yeah, all the same, like, different women, different wives, same guy, different aliases. In September 1914, he then went on to marry Alice Reed under the alias Charles Oliver James. So, between 1908 to 1914, he had entered into 7 bigamous marriages. And in most of these cases, he was content to just go through all of his wife's possessions and then kind of just disappear. Now, one evening in January 1915, Division Detective Inspector Arthur Neal received a letter from a Joseph Crossley, who Joseph owned a boarding house in Blackpool. Together with the letter were 2 newspaper clippings. One was from the News of the World, dated before Christmas 1914, about a tragic death of a Margaret Elizabeth Lloyd. Now, Margaret Lloyd, her maiden name, Lofty, so Margaret Lofty. And she was aged just 38, who died in her lodgings in 14 Bismarck Road, Highgate. She was found in her bathtub by her husband, John Lloyd, and their landlady. Now, the other clipping contained the report of a coroner's inquest dated the 13th of December 1913. So this was a year before, in Blackpool. It was about a woman named Alice Smith, her maiden name Burnham, Alice Burnham, who died suddenly in a boarding house in that city while taking a bath in her bathtub. She was found by her husband, George Smith. The letter, dated the 3rd of January, was written by Crossley, the landlord of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, on behalf of Crossley's wife and a Mr. Charles Burnham, who both expressed their suspicion on the striking similarity of the 2 incidents and they urged the police to investigate the matter. Now, Inspector Neal, he went to 14 Bismarck Road, where Mr. and Mrs. Lloyd had taken the lodgings on the 17th of December. The landlady found it peculiar that before they took the room, Mr. Lloyd examined the bathroom first, which we all love a good bathroom, don't get me wrong, but it's not the first place that you examine.
I think it depends. If it was a hotel, for example, and it had a main bathroom, I probably wouldn't want to stay there. But
yeah,
it's not the first place I'd go.
No. And then also as well, we're in the early 1900s. Like, how many people actually had a bathroom? You'd no doubt just have a bath in front of the fire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, fair, fair.
Your toilet. So he's just being crazy. Now, the bathtub was 50 inches long and 66 inches at the top. So Neil found it hard to believe that an adult like Mrs. Lloyd could have even drowned in such a small tub, especially since the tub was only 3/4 full when her body was found. He then went to the coroner, a Dr. Bates, who signed the death certificate and cautiously asked if there were signs of violence on the woman. There was none, except for a tiny bruise above the left elbow. However, what was striking about the whole thing was that Mr. Lloyd, shock horror, hadn't shown any grief at all, and he just ordered, you know, the cheapest coffin for his late wife and just buried her and moved on with his life.
Oh, it's so common, eh?
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong, coffins are expensive, but show some respect. Now, upon further investigation, Neil was able to learn that a will was made on the 18th, just 3 hours before Margaret Lloyd died. So this is the 18th of December. And you guessed it, the sole beneficiary was none other than her husband, Mr. Lloyd. And, you know, Mr. Lloyd quickly submitted this to the solicitor for settlement. In addition, Mrs. Lloyd withdrew all her savings on that same day she made the will. On the 12th of January, Dr. Bates called. He had an inquiry from the Yorkshire Insurance Company about the death of Margaret Lloyd. She had, like we said, 3 days before she was married, taken out a life insurance policy for £700 with her husband, John Lloyd, as sole beneficiary. Neil promptly asked the doctor to stall in his reply, you know, for the settlement. At once, he asked for more data on the Smith case from the Blackpool police. So Mrs. Smith likewise took out a life insurance policy and made a will in her husband's favour and took lodgings in Blackpool only after her husband, Mr. Smith, inspected the bathtub. Convinced that he was now dealing with the same man, Neil asked the coroner to issue a favourable report to the insurance company. He was counting on the man to get in touch with his solicitor, and he had the office watched day and night. At last, on the 1st of February, a man fitting Lloyd's or Smith's or whoever you want to call him description appeared, because his description was the exact same. It's the same man. Inspector Neil introduced himself and asked him whether he was John Lloyd. Yes, he replied. Detective Neil then asked him whether he was also George Smith, and he denied it. He was disgusted. Inspector Neil, already sure that, you know, they were the same person, told him that he would take him for questioning because of bigamy. So this man finally admitted that he
was I was going to say, of course he was going to deny it. Like, it would have been too easy. Imagine. And he said, yes, it was me. End of episode.
Yeah, the end. So he was getting questioned, and then because he was going to get to questioned just for bigamy, he confirmed that he was George Smith as well. Now, he obviously, well, not obviously, but it's a guess, he confirmed that because, you know, you would rather admit to having committed bigamy than murder. So he was under arrest. When Smith was arrested for the charge of bigamy and suspicion of murder, the renowned pathologist Bernard Spilsbury was asked to determine how the woman died. Although he was the Home Office pathologist and acted mainly in a consulting capacity, he was also available for direct assistance to the police force. Margaret Lloyd's body was exhumed, and Spilsbury's first task was to confirm drowning as the cause of death. So, was it by accident? Or was it by force? He confirmed the tiny bruise on the elbow, as noted before, as well as two microscopic marks. Even the evidence of drowning was not extensive. There were no signs of heart or circulatory disease, but the evidence suggested that death was almost instantaneous, as if the victim died of a sudden stroke. Poison was also seen as a possibility, and so Spilsbury ordered tests on its presence. Finally, he proposed to Neil that they run some experiments in the very same bathtub in which Margaret died. So Neil had it set up in the police station. I'll get back onto this experiment in due course. Now, despite the exhumation, that wasn't in English, sorry, despite the exhumation being carried out as discreetly as possible, you know it, the press got wind of the story and they have named it Brides in the Baths. So that's when,
of course,
they love a tagline. Now, on the 8th of February, the chief of police of Herne Bay, which was a small seaside resort in Kent, had read the stories, and then he sent Neil a report of another death which was strikingly similar to the other two. So in a way, I guess it was good that the press got involved. Now, a year before Alice Burnham's death in Blackpool, Henry William had rented a house in 80 High Street with no bath for himself and his wife, Beatrice Mundy. She was known as Bessie. He had married her in Weymouth in 1910. He then rented a bathtub just 7 weeks later. He took his wife to a local doctor, Frank French, due to supposed attack of epilepsy. Although Mrs. Williams was only complaining of headaches, to which the doctor prescribed some medication. But again, early 1900s, you're getting taken there by your husband, and it's like, oh, doctor, she's suffering from this, and I guess you just kind of have to go along with it. On the 12th of July...
I know, you shouldn't laugh, but that is like, imagine being like, what's your symptoms? A headache, and the husband's like, nah, the epilepsy, and the doctor's like, fair enough.
Yeah, and then if you're like, but it's not, it's like, oh, this woman's just hysterical. Take it away.
Whereas, yeah, nowadays you go to the doctor being like, I let's say I'm dying, and they're like, wet paper towel.
Yeah, they're like, here's some paracetamol, off you go. On the 12th of July, 1912, Mr. Williams woke up Dr. French, saying that his wife was having another attack. He checked on her and promised to come back the following afternoon. However, he was surprised when on the following morning he was informed by Mr. Williams that his wife had died of drowning. The doctor found Bessie Williams in the tub, her head underwater, her legs stretched out straight and her feet protruding out of the water. There was no trace of violence, so Dr. French attributed the drowning to an attack of epilepsy. The inquest jury was apparently convinced and awarded Mr. Williams the amount of £2,579, as stipulated in Mrs. Williams's will, made up just 5 days before her death. Detective Neil then sent photographs of Smith to Herne Bay for possible identification and went to Blackpool, where Spilsbury was conducting an autopsy of Alice Williams. Again, the results were the same as with Margaret Lloyd. You know, there was a huge lack of violence. Every suggestion of instantaneous death, like there was very little evidence of drowning. Furthermore, there were no traces of poison on Margaret Lloyd. So they were baffled. So Spilsbury took routine measurements of the corpse and he had the bathtub sent to London. Now, back in London, Neil had received confirmation from Herne Bay that Henry Williams was the same man as John Lloyd and George Smith. So this time, when Spilsbury examined Bessie Williams, he found one sure sign of drowning: the presence of goosebumps on the skin, which I did not know. As with the other two deaths, the tubs where Mrs. William died was sent to London.
See, before you start, see the goosebumps. How is that proof of drowning then?
Yeah, I believe so. I didn't.
I was going to say, glad I asked. Like, I was, yeah, I didn't know that was a thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool, to be honest. Like, that's a sign that they can then be like, I was drowning.
Yeah. I've never heard of it before. Please, anyone message us if we're absolutely talking shite. Now, for weeks, Spilsbury pondered over the bathtubs and the victims' measurements. Supposing he thought that Bessie Williams had indeed had an epileptic fit. Its first stage consists of a stiffening and extension of the entire body. Considering her height, she was 5'7", and the length of the tub was just 5 feet, the upper part of her body would have been pushed up the sloping head of the tub, far above the level of the water. The second stage would consist of violent spasms of the limbs, which were drawn up to the body and then flung outward. Therefore, no one of her size could possibly get underwater, especially when her muscles would relax on the third stage. The tub was just simply too small. Suddenly, he hit upon a possible solution. Using Dr. French's description of Bessie Williams when he found her in the bathtub, Spilsbury reasoned that Smith, under the pretense of a lover's teasing, must have seized Bessie by the feet and suddenly pulled them up towards himself, sliding the upper part of the body underwater. The sudden flood of water into her nose and throat might cause shock and sudden loss of consciousness. This would explain the absence of injuries and minimal signs of drowning. To try out Spilsbury's theory, Neil hired several experienced women divers of the same size and build as all the victims. He tried to push them underwater. This is an experiment they're doing, by the way, with actual bathtubs, water and people.
Which is impressive, to be honest, especially for the time.
Yeah, 100%. Now, he tried to push them underwater by force, but there would be inevitable signs of struggle. Finally, Neil did what Spilsbury had suggested. He unexpectedly pulled the feet of one of the divers and her head glided underwater before she knew what was happening. Suddenly...
Fuck's sake, what a poor woman. Imagine volunteering to help the police with this, being like, yeah, I'm drowning.
Yep, completely drowned.
I'd be soon.
Now, Detective Neil, as we're all expecting here, he was alarmed when he saw that the woman that he had just pulled underwater by her ankles was no longer moving. So he quickly pulled her.
Lion.
Yeah. Now she has, like, I know you're taking part in an experiment. It's all great, but he's just practically drowned her. So he quickly pulled her out of the tub and it took him and a doctor over half an hour before they were able to revive her. So they did CPR, but they revived her, thank God. Now, when she came to...
No, that is actually too much. When she came to, she was like, I'm fucking suing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what she said.
Hopefully she got some compensation or something. But when she came to...
Sorry for drowning you. Love the police force.
Kiss, kiss. Now, when she came to, she related that the only thing she remembered was the rush of water before she then lost complete consciousness. Now, I don't know if you've heard of this, but I'm sure everybody has, but I believe drowning is probably apparently one of the most peaceful ways of dying. Not the whole part of getting hailed underwater.
No, I think it is once that you, like, once you're in there, over the fight, yeah.
Yeah, it's apparently very peaceful. Now, this, though, despite the fact that she expected the attack and was an experienced diver, she still managed to get drowned right away. So, Spilsbury's theory, it was confirmed. George Joseph Smith was charged for the murders of Bessie Williams, Alice Smith and Margaret Lloyd on the 23rd of March 1915. Now, on the 22nd of June, he went to trial at the Old Bailey. The prosecution counsel were Archibald Bodkin, and he later became the Director of Public Prosecutions, and Cecil Whitley. Although he could only be tried for the murder of Bessie Williams, in accordance with English law at the time, the prosecution used the deaths of the other two women to establish a pattern of Smith's crimes. Now, this was allowed by Mr. Justice Scruton, despite the protests of Smith's counsel, Sir Edward Marshall Hall. Now, it was because this was kind of the start of them being able to, like, use things to describe patterns of people, and that, you know, yeah, we can only try him on this one murder, but these other women who he might have killed, this shows a complete pattern. And obviously his counsel were like, oh shit, this isn't good. Now, Smith decided not to give evidence in his own defence, indicating this to Marshall Hall in a handwritten note. It took the jury about 20 minutes on the 1st of July to find him guilty, and he was sentenced to death. Smith's appeal against his verdict and his sentence, it was just dismissed, because it was like, no, you did it. And on the 13th of August, he was hung in Maidstone Prison by John Ellis. And that is the
I really enjoyed.
The bath.
Sorry, I really enjoyed you there as the appeal, and they just said no. That's how it works.
Yeah, well, they might have written something, but I mean, I would be like, no.
It's such a wild one, because see, if he hadn't committed like the first two, the bride with epilepsy, that's actually a very believable argument. Like, if yes. She has had a recent diagnosis of epilepsy, she has taken a seizure in the bath and drowned, like, that would be like a case closed, basically, because they wouldn't have had the ability to do the autopsy and realise, did she have epilepsy? Like, when did she last have a seizure? They wouldn't be able to do that back then. So actually, fine. But it's because he obviously just got greedy and started doing this too quick.
Yeah.
Which sounds so silly, but it is. Like, if he had actually taken a minute to think, and actually, you know, we say this about so many killers, that they just get so greedy and are just like, yeah, I'll just kill them, like, quickly, done like this, da-da-da, and it's like, actually, that's where you then slip up.
Yeah, but I agree with you.
Wild.
Crazy. Like, but, I mean, how would you even know? I'm going to grab their ankles. That's also, I would just like to say, you know those really nice, beautiful freestanding baths that people have in their bathroom? Like,
yeah.
That is one reason why when I got my bathroom done, mine's is swiftly against a wall. Like, I have an imagination. This story does not help. So it's actually just, you know, confirmed my fear, which is legit.
They do give me the fear. Like, yep. I was absolute panicking somebody the other day, one of my friends, because I'm interested to see if you think this here. I will sometimes sleep in the bath.
With a kebab. That's my experience of you.
No, in the bath. You can't say that on the podcast. I was very hungover. I was vulnerable. Leave me alone. Anyway, it was one time. I do not eat kebabs in the bath. Stop
no,
it.
No, no.
I was embarrassed. No, but I will have like a sleep in the bath. And my friend Louise
Yeah,
was like,
that's very dangerous.
yeah, she was like, you're gonna die. And I was like, but I'm quite tall, so like I need to decide anyway, is my top half or my legs out of the bath? So I was like, I wouldn't completely drown, but
You would drown in my bath. Not that I'd be at the end
right.
pulling you
That is a
out.
threat. Can everyone please? If
No,
I end up drowning, it was Samantha.
no, because my bath is now quite long. So even though we're tall, like you're drowning if you fall asleep and you slide down. I'm
Fair,
just saying
whereas.
it's very dangerous. Do not do it. But I know
Right,
you
okay.
will. Keep doing
Also,
it.
let us know if anyone else sleeps in the bath, if I, or if I really should stop doing this.